This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to part of Terry's interview with Sebastian Younger. Younger has reported from many war zones. He's been kidnapped. He's been nearly killed. But his own close calls with death didn't have the impact of the death of his friend, photojournalist Tim Hetherington. Hetherington and Younger had collaborated on the documentary Restrepo, which followed a platoon of American soldiers in Afghanistan. It was nominated for an Oscar in 2011. 6 weeks after attending the Oscar ceremony, Hetherington was killed by mortar shrapnel in Libya. Younger was originally supposed to go to Libya with Hetherington. After Hetherington was killed, Younger made a documentary about his late friend's life and work. It's called Which Way is the Front Line from Here? It premiered on HBO on April 18th. You may also know Younger as the author of the bestseller The Perfect Storm, which was adapted into the film of the same name. This new documentary begins with archival footage from outtakes of an interview with Tim Hetherington, in which he's trying to sum up his motivation for working in war zones.
I think the important thing for me is to make work that is connected to people. You know, I like to... I think the important thing for me is to connect with real people, you know, to document them in these extreme circumstances, you know, where there aren't any kind of neat solutions or where you can't put any kind of neat guidelines and say this is what it's about or this is what it's about. It's not. I hope that my work kind of shows that.
Yeah, that was strong.
Yeah.
Sebastian Younger, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the film. I think it's a beautiful testament to Tim Hetherington and just a very moving and revealing portrait of some, of a war photojournalist who did really important work. He was obviously really kind of self-conscious describing what he did and why he did it. I feel like you did that job for him in this film. Would you describe for us why you thought he was such a great photojournalist?
Frankly, I think he was a great photojournalist because ultimately he wasn't that interested in photography per se. The camera was almost the excuse that he used to engage with people. And I would watch him engage with people even when he didn't have a camera in his hand, you know, in a taxi cab in New York City. He'd be talking to the driver and trying to understand what country he came from and what's it like to come to America. And he just did that all the time with everyone. He was really curious and deeply compassionate as well, but always curious about the human experience. American soldiers, I mean, the powerful, the weak, it didn't matter who it was. He just had a great curiosity. And that meant that he had, very quickly he would develop an emotional relationship with the person he was talking to, in seconds even. What he captured with his camera was that emotional relationship. And so his photos were extraordinary, but I think in his mind they weren't even really the point. Tim's focus, I've been struggling to come up with words to describe his focus in life and in his work, and the phrase I've come up with, and I think it describes it quite well, is the quiet dignity of the human struggle. I mean, that is what Tim was focused on.
Would you give an example for us that either you saw through watching clips that he, watching video and film that he shot over the years, or an example that you witnessed yourself while making Restrepo of how he once risked his life to get a shot or a scene, even though he said he knew he shouldn't risk his life for a picture?
Well, my main experience with Tim happened in Afghanistan at a small outpost called Restrepo. He and I made a movie by that name, documenting the lives of a platoon of soldiers at a remote outpost for a year. And everyone up there was almost killed, you know, in very specific ways. I mean, I had a bullet impact a few inches from my head at the beginning of a firefight. We all had an experience like that. And so it was just understood by Tim and by myself that being up there meant that you were, on some level, you had to be prepared that for your own death. The understanding was that if you were going to be out there, you had to make peace with the idea that you might die. It wasn't likely that that we would die, but it was absolutely a possibility. And we both felt that what we were doing, and I think more generally journalists feel that what they're doing in war zones in documenting essentially a massive tragedy, that what we're doing is incredibly important to the world, to the people involved in the tragedy, and that it's worth some risk to our lives. That doesn't mean out on the front line that you should be a complete daredevil and cowboy. And, you know, I know journalists like that, and you really stay clear of them because they're dangerous. Tim was not that way. He was very calculating. He was very cautious. He was an interesting combination of very, very brave, physically brave, and very cautious, almost to the point of sort of fearfulness. It was a very funny combination.
How did you meet him?
I was doing a project that I had brought to Vanity Fair of following a platoon for a year in combat. And I was there on my first trip out there in the Korangal Valley with a photographer, a friend of mine actually, and it just wasn't quite working. I was shooting all the video, and it just wasn't quite the collaboration I wanted. So we started looking for other photographers. Tim was sort of top on the list. I interviewed him. He's an amazing photographer. I knew he'd been in combat. I asked if he was in shape, because what the journalists out there have to do is physically very, very hard. And he said, well, when you meet me, you'll see that I'm rather lean, sort of typical British understatement. And so I said, well, you know, in addition to the Vanity Fair assignment, I'm writing a book about this, and I'm trying to make a documentary, and I'm hoping you'll become interested in it and shoot some video. And so when we went out there together in September 07, he was just entranced by the story. He thought it was incredible. And on his following trip in October, he started shooting video as well, and we started collaborating. And eventually, when we got home after the deployment, we pulled all of the money that we had that we could spare, and we hired an editor for a year. The film was completely self-funded, and at the end of that, we managed to sell it to National Geographic. And by the end of that process, we were extremely close friends.
Toward the beginning of Restrepo, the documentary that you made with Tim Hetherington in Afghanistan, the camera is rolling, and it's a Jeep or a tank. I
was in a Humvee.
It was a Humvee. And it's rocked by an IED explosion. Was that you or Tim behind the camera?
That was me shooting that.
Would you describe the experience of shooting that?
It was really odd. The captain who was in the front passenger seat said to me, you know, we're getting into kind of a tricky area. If we're going to get attacked, and I think we will, it'll probably be RPGs, and it'll be in the next, you know, half mile or so. And so I had the camera rolling, right, because I was shooting a lot of stuff. I was in the back seat. And all of a sudden, there was this enormous sort of crunching sound. And everything turned orange and then dark. And the dark came from all the dirt that came down on the windshield and sort of enclosed us in darkness. And IED had gone off under the engine block. So it wasn't directly under us. The timing was a little off, which spared us injury, I'm sure. The IED was actually made from a pressure cooker, exactly like the terrible bomb that exploded at the Boston Marathon a few days ago.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a pressure cooker bomb. That's right. And in Boston, you know, I was right down the street on Commonwealth Ave at BU waiting to premiere my film about Tim at the JFK Library. You know, here's this horrible situation in Boston. Several people killed, multiple amputations, many, many injuries from an explosion. It's exactly the kind of attack that Tim died in, except with Tim it was in a war zone and it was an 81 millimeter mortar, but it was the exact same kind of thing. And it really, all those different connections really, you know, I've stopped war reporting, but all those different connections really kind of rattled me, actually.
So the Humvee is rocked by an IED explosion. You're in the Humvee shooting it for your film, and the camera keeps rolling. I mean, you keep shooting.
That's right. I mean, I forgot. I did keep shooting, didn't I? So here's the thing. If you're in danger, if you're putting yourself in danger in combat, if you don't keep recording what's happening, you're putting yourself in danger for nothing.
Uh-huh.
It's utterly stupid. And so it's actually easier to keep rolling when you're in combat, because at least it gives the risk you're taking some meaning. it's very, very hard. The only time I've been really scared in combat was when I couldn't get to my camera because it was 10 feet away and there was too much gunfire to get to it, and I had nothing to do, and I just felt stupid. And so in the back of the Humvee, we're there, the Humvee's on fire, and I'm rolling, and I'm adjust. You know, you go into shock a little bit. Like, combat's not that scary, actually, because it's scary beforehand. The anticipation is very scary, and afterwards, the fear catches up with you. But in combat, you're really very calm, or at least I am. And I adjusted the filter setting on the camera because it was darker in the Humvee, and I was so not scared, I thought I'd been wounded. And I sort of felt my way down my legs to make sure everything was there and I was all right. My heart rate, I don't think, went above 60 beats a minute. I mean, I had no physical reaction to the shock at all. I thought, I have to be wounded. I'm in shock. This isn't possible. In fact, I was just really calm, and I kept shooting and waiting for the RPG impacts. I thought we were going to get hit by RPGs. Eventually, they'll penetrate a Humvee. And I was like, oh, my God, this is it. There was a lot of shooting outside. I'm like, God, we're going to have to bail out and run through that stuff. Like, but I wasn't scared at all. I was scared. I was very scared later. About 6 hours later, I really kind of crashed, actually.
Tim Hetherington called the outpost in Afghanistan Man Eden. What did he mean?
Well, it was this strangely idyllic place. All the annoying complications of life back home are absent. Right? There's no fights with your girlfriend, no bills to pay, no hassles. It's really simple out there. You just have to not get killed. You have to do your job. You have to not get anyone else killed. And you got to keep your weapon clean. I mean, it's really simple. And so the guys, you know, I don't know how women act in groups by themselves, because I'm not obviously in a situation like that. Men in groups by themselves get incredibly funny. Really, really funny. And they get very, very close. And three men, five men, 20 men. I mean, a platoon is really, it's a sort of ongoing comedy hour. And there's a lot of hard work, and they can sort of test each other in that way with pickaxes and shovels. And there's this incredibly intense thing going on called combat that sort of visits you every once in a while. And it sort of plays to all of the sensibilities of young men. In this sort of outrageous way, and it is a kind of Eden. The only thing that's not out there of any importance that young men like is women. And otherwise, in a sense, it's a pretty perfect place for these guys at this age, at this point in their lives.
We've been talking about the documentary that you made with Tim Hetherington in Afghanistan, Restrepo. And you've been telling us about some of your experiences while shooting that documentary. I want to get to something that Tim did there that is so different from the kind of, you know, war documentary that we've been talking about. He did a series of still photographs of the soldiers in this platoon sleeping. And I've never seen a series like that. It's remarkable. I'm really glad you included it in the documentary. What was his motivation for photographing them while they slept?
I remember when he shot those photos. It was one of the trips when we were together. It was a very hot day, boring day, that we hadn't been in a firefight in at least a week, if not more. And the guys were just zoned out, and they were soldiers kind of sleep as much as they can. One of them said to me, you know, if you sleep half the time, it's only a six-month deployment. And and so they were sleeping in the middle of the day, sprawled on the ground in their bunks and these little plywood hooches that they made, and the flies were buzzing around, and Tim was scuttling around photographing them. I was like, Tim, man, what are you doing? I mean, it was the ultimate situation where nothing's going on journalistically and you can just space out. And he said, don't you get it? Like, all the photos you see of soldiers, they're all geared up and they've got their weapons and they're all tough looking. But when they're asleep, they look like what they really are, which are little boys. They did. They all look like they're about 10 years old. So vulnerable, you know, and no nation wants to think that their soldiers are vulnerable too. But of course they are. And Tim saw that. And he saw the photographic possibilities in it, and he saw the truth in it. And what for most journalists would have been a boring day with nothing going on, for Tim was this opportunity to do something that had never been done before, which is to photograph the vulnerability of soldiers as they lie asleep in a combat outpost. And I think it captures the truth about war as much as any photo of a guy shooting a gun. I think there are in some ways kind of iconic photographs, you know, now iconic photographs of war.
In your documentary about Tim Hetherington, you said that he was ready to give up war, you know, at least one of the interviewees says that. He seemed to be ready. But after you went to the Oscars as nominees for Restrepo, he decided, this was in 2011, he decided to go to Libya during the Arab Spring. Why do you think he went back? Went back into war?
I think he went back into war because war has a tremendous gravitational pull, which is really hard to resist. I think he wanted to think of himself as capable of stopping because he wanted a life back home and a family and all that. But I think he worried that he wasn't going to be able to stop. And he was right in that moment of trying to figure it out. Tim and I were supposed to be on assignment for Vanity Fair in Libya. And we, at the Oscars, we saw all this exploding overseas, and we thought, we got to get back out there. We're journalists. What are we doing here on these red carpets? As fun as it was. And we had an assignment. At the last minute, I had to change my plans for personal reasons, and Tim continued on his own to do a project that didn't involve front lines, actually. He wanted to shoot portraits of the rebel fighters, you know, sort of behind the front lines. You know, just almost formal portraits of them all geared up in what they thought they should look like. This is their first war. They don't know how to dress for it. You know, these are young kids, right? They've never fought before, and they don't know how to dress for their first day on the front line, you know? And so they dress. Tim realized that they would dress themselves up and act and pose in ways that mimicked what they'd seen in Hollywood movies and in other images of other young men in other wars. And he became really interested in that kind of feedback loop. And he wanted to do a series of portraits of these guys using a large format or medium format camera and film. He was shooting film out there, right? I mean, who does that in a war zone? That was his project. And he got out there, and the gravitational pull of the front line started to exert its influence on him. And all of a sudden, he was in a burning building, you know, with rebel forces, rebel fighters who were fighting room to room with hand grenades, trying to clear Gaddafi soldiers out of the out of the building. Incredibly dangerous situation. Yet suddenly, there he was, and he died later that day
from shrapnel, from a mortar round. And it sounds like he basically bled out.
Yeah, later that afternoon, there wasn't a lot of shooting. It had quietened down, but they were out at the front line, and a single 81-millimeter mortar came in. They were clustered, unfortunately. They were clustered in a group, a bunch of journalists and rebel fighters, and a mortar came in and detonated and mortally injured a wonderful photographer named Chris Hondros. He was hit in the head with shrapnel. I don't think there's much anyone could have done for him, actually. Tim, on the other hand, was hit in the groin with shrapnel, and he had a femoral artery bleed, and he started bleeding heavily, and he died over the course of the next 4 or 5 minutes in the back of a rebel pickup truck racing for the Misrata hospital. The particular tragedy there was that a femoral artery bleed is very dangerous, but it's not necessarily a mortal wound. And had there been a combat medic nearby, Tim might have lived. I mean, you just have to slow down the blood loss enough so that you can deliver the person to real medical help at a hospital alive. And then once they're in the hospital, they can get blood transfusions. Now you're back in the game. But none of the journalists there knew anything about combat medicine or were equipped for it. So when I learned that, I decided to start a group called Reporters Instructed in Saving Colleagues, RISC, R-I-S-C. And it's a nonprofit. It's entirely devoted to training experienced, not hopeful, but experienced freelance war reporters. The journalists who are on staff at the networks, et cetera, are all medically trained because it's mandated by their insurance companies. But the freelancers do probably 90% of the war reporting out there, and none of them have any training because they're not supported by any organization. They're just out there on their own. So I started this group. It's a 4-day intensive medical training course in New York City. Is completely free. The hotel, the training, the medical kit, it's completely free for the people that are accepted into the program. They just have to get themselves to New York.
You've said that it's not that traumatic to nearly get killed, although you've described how traumatic it is a few minutes ago. But you say deep trauma comes from the pain of others, you know, from losing others. Were you prepared for the trauma of losing Tim for someone who you'd been so close to because you worked in war together, even though you were often in Afghanistan at separate times. You were there together as well.
The times that I've been in real danger, I don't think back on with any emotion. They don't make me sad. They don't make me upset. It's just a memory, right? The things that I think back on and get quite emotional about is when other people were hurt and other people were suffering. Tim's death was a really deep shock and trauma to me. It finally connected in my mind the inescapable tragedy of war. And I know it sounds strange to say that, but when you go to war, you're bombarded by so many different experiences, and so many of them are meaningful and intense and even pleasurable. I mean, the camaraderie in a small group in combat is very pleasurable. You know, the excitement is very intense. I mean, it's a lot of good stuff happens out there too, and stuff you can't get back home. So it's possible to miss the central point, which is that it's all just awfully tragic as well. And when Tim died, that point was driven home in a way that I couldn't avoid and ultimately didn't want to avoid. And within an hour, I decided not to cover combat again. I didn't want to risk traumatizing everyone I loved by getting killed myself. I mean, you go to war, you think you're gambling with your own life, and then I realized that what you're really doing is gambling with everyone else's lives, everyone who cares about you. You're dead. You don't matter. It's over. Like, it's everyone else who has to deal with it. I hadn't really gotten that either. And when Tim died, I did. And I also just ran headlong into the central tragedy of war, which is that good people get killed. And I sort of didn't want to have anything to do with it anymore.
Sebastian Younger speaking with Terry Gross. You'll find a longer version of their conversation on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. The release of Brad Paisley's new album, Wheelhouse, was somewhat overshadowed by the instant controversy provoked by one of its songs, Accidental Racist, a duet co-written and performed by Paisley and LL Cool J. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of the album and the song.
When your wheelhouse is the land of cotton, the first time you leave, it can be strange, it can be shocking. Not everybody drives a truck, not everybody drinks sweet tea, not everybody owns a gun, wears a ball cap, boots and jeans, not everybody goes to church, watches every NASCAR race, not everybody knows.
Brad Paisley's Wheelhouse is yet another very good album from a singer-guitarist-songwriter who's made a bunch of them in a row now. It features a slew of shrewd songs about finding pleasure and comfort in a frequently unpleasant, uncomfortable world. The music includes a bone-cracking song about domestic violence written from a woman's point of view, one that praises Christian values from the point of view of a jealous skeptic, and one that samples the great Roger Miller as deftly as any hip-hop production.
On tables at Claire Bell's cafe. Now she's waiting on a bench for Johnny at the end of another hard day. Hey, hey, just got paid for washing all them cars. They ain't going to the movies and they ain't going to a bar. They're gonna pick up the cake. I'm gonna pick up the ice. And we're gonna show you how the experts kill us a Friday.
This album, Wheelhouse, also features a song that has threatened to overshadow everything else on it, Accidental Racist, a Let's All Get Together collaboration between Paisley and LL Cool J. Its vexed subject is, as Paisley phrases it, the feeling of being, quote, caught between Southern pride and Southern blame. LL Cool J has taken his lumps for providing lines like, "Now my chains are gold, but I'm still misunderstood." Those who criticize Paisley accuse him of naivete to the point of stupidity. Those who criticize LL Cool J have tended to frame it as a sign of cheerful sellout, much like his co-starring in a mediocre yet big-hit TV show, NCIS Los Angeles. But both accusations actually suggest the naivete of the hipper-than-thou.
To the man that waited on me at the Starbucks down on Main, I hope you understand. When I put on that t-shirt, the only thing I meant to say is I'm a Skinnerd fan. The red flag on my chest somehow's like the elephant in the corner of the south. And I just walked him right in the room. Just a proud rebel son with an old can of worms, looking like I got a lot to learn. But from my point of view, I'm just a white man coming to you from the Southland, trying to understand what it's like not to be. I'm proud of where I'm from, but not everything we've done.
Mr. White Man, I wish you understood what the world is really like when you're living in the hood. Just because my pants are sagging doesn't mean I'm up to no good. You should try to get to know me, I really wish you would. Now my chains are gold, but I'm still misunderstood. I wasn't there when Sherman's march turned the South into firewood. I want you to get paid, but be a slave, I never could. Feel like a newfangled jangle, dodging invisible white hoods. So when I see that white cowboy hat, I'm thinking it's not all good. I guess we're both guilty of judging the cover, not the book. I'd love to buy you a beer, conversate and clear the air. But I see that red flag, and I think you wish I wasn't here. If you don't judge my durag, I won't judge your red flag.
Accidental Racist's biggest sin is that its well-meaning topples over into sentimentality too easily, and that its melody, something Paisley usually constructs with a firm complexity bolstered by his superb guitar playing, is here merely a languid loop designed to let the lyrics take precedence. Haters probably aren't aware of what one might call other message songs of Paisley's. He's particularly good at navigating sexual politics in older songs, such as The Pants and Waiting on a Woman, as well as politics, such as the song Welcome to the Future, which in 2009 reached out to country's conservative base with a full-throated argument for Barack Obama's vision of America in a way that very few artists in any genre could pull off. So forgive me and Paisley and LL Cool J if we all feel that a lot of the current criticism isn't merely misplaced, but itself naive. It's too bad Paisley felt it necessary to go on TV with Jay Leno and Ellen DeGeneres to do damage control for Accidental Racist. It further compounds the misguided notion that songs are primarily words set to music. Whereas this album as a whole, and indeed the rest of Paisley's career, does the more invigorating, valuable work of demonstrating that first-rate pop songs make those elements inextricable from each other and yield subtleties that neither slogans nor ridicule can touch.
Ken Tucker is Fresh Air's rock critic. He reviewed Brad Paisley's new album, Wheelhouse. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
Can't rewrite history, baby.
Oh, Dixieland.
The relationship between the Mason Dixon needs some fixing.
I hope you understand.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli in for Terry Gross. In 2003, police in Somerset County, New Jersey, arrested a hospital nurse named Charlie Cullen, who was suspected of injecting patients with lethal doses of a variety of medications. Cullen would turn out to be one of the nation's most prolific serial killers, murdering dozens, perhaps hundreds of people, in 9 hospitals over a 16-year period. Journalist Charles Graber spent 6 years investigating the Cullen case and is the only reporter to speak to Cullen in prison. Graber's new book, The Good Nurse, focuses not only on Cullen's tortured life and crimes, but on why it took so long to stop him, despite plenty of evidence he was harming patients. Charles Graber has written for Wired, GQ, New York Magazine, and other publications. The Good Nurse is his first book. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Charles Graber, welcome to Fresh Air. This is a remarkable story, both of a serial killer and what drove him to commit these crimes, but also one about the healthcare system and its vulnerability to someone who abuses patients. And I want to start with one of his, maybe his earliest employment at the St. Barnabas Medical Center in Livingston, New Jersey. And you write that in 1991, he'd been there a few years, and some of the staff noticed some weird stuff. What did they find?
Right. Well, he'd been there since 87. It was his first job out of nursing school. And on the ICU ward and the CCU wards, they started finding that patients were mysteriously crashing. They would hook a patient up to an IV that was supposed to have saline or something of the like, and the patient became a magical diabetic, and where they were on this terrible diabetic roller coaster ride, woozing in and out of consciousness and burning through sugar, and they couldn't outfeed the fire. And then eventually they'd get so bad that they'd unhook them from the lines and rush them in for more emergency procedures. And once they unhooked the lines, everything changed.
That's the line connected to an IV bag, right?
Correct, correct. So once they unhooked them from the IV, they were okay. And trial and error, a few of these on the ward, and they started questioning the IV bags themselves and brought them in and found that, in fact, they'd been compromised. There were extra pinpricks in them, and when they analyzed the IV bags, they found that instead of containing saline, the IV bags that had been stored in the medical closet also contained insulin.
So it appeared someone had taken a hypodermic needle with insulin and injected them into the IV bags, leaving virtually no trace and then causing catastrophic consequences for the patients.
Exactly, and it was the only conclusion anyone could come to, but it was beyond thinking, because why would anyone do that? Who would do that? Suspicion immediately fell to somebody with a specific vendetta, some sort of family member, or, you know, it was really very abstract. The hospital had never dealt with anything like this before. And eventually, nurses were cross-indexed, shifts were cross-indexed, and a few names came together, and one name finally stood out more than any, at least according to the head of security there. And that name was Charles Cullen.
And he was the nurse at the center of this. Now, did some of these folks die?
People died at St. Barnabas. It's very difficult to say who died of what. St. Barnabas is so long ago, and at the time, they didn't catch him. I mean, they had him. They strongly suspected him. Tom Arnold says he knew Cullen was dirty, but could they prove it?
So the investigation focuses on him. What happens?
Well, he's investigated, pressured, interviewed, tells them essentially there's nothing you can do. You can't hold me. You don't have anything on me. You're just picking on me. Leaves, is contemptuous, which really riles the detectives, former cops. They go to the chief of police in the town of Livingston, and the chief, for whatever reason, bounces it right back to the hospital, says, this is internal. You guys deal with it. You figure out what happens. And they don't figure out what happens. Cullen ends up as a floater. He's basically working at the hospital full time, but he's staffed by an outside but wholly owned staffing agency of the hospital, which makes tying him to the hospital and specific shifts all the more difficult. And they're still investigating when suddenly they stop giving him shifts. It's not technically being fired. He's just no longer on the list, and he moves on.
Okay.
And their problems move on with him.
What's fascinating is he goes down to the next job, and when they ask about previous employment, he lists St. Barnabas, the place where they discovered him effectively killing people.
Sure.
And any impact?
No. I mean, in fact, it worked out really well because they fired him in the beginning of January, and he managed to get over to applying to his next hospital, which was Warren Hospital, at the end of January of 1992. And so he was able to say dates of employment X date to January 1992, which made it look like he was currently employed and simply wanted a change rather than having been canned. And he was given neutral references, which was the norm and the pattern over and over again. And during a nursing shortage with neutral references, seemingly, you know, a nurse that was willing to work nights and weekends and holidays and seemed to bring extra energy with every shift and a lot of experience, that was a nurse worth hiring.
Now, I have to note that this happened in 1991, I think 12 years before the investigation that ultimately caught him. This was clearly he'd been doing enormous damage, possibly killing patients, and he moves on, works at another 7 hospitals, right?
Total of 9, yeah.
Right, okay, so another 8 then. Now, was there any requirement that hospitals report this stuff to the state health department or an agency that regulates nursing?
Yeah, you really have to look at that case by case, and that's one of the reasons I took on this book and the reason it took as many years as it did. Some incidents, sentinel events, events that result in actions that are of potential harm to patients, are supposed to be reported, state nursing board. Other incidents, such as medication errors that are more routine, he had a lot of those as well, and it's again, difficult to sort out which were legitimate mistakes and which were simply the MO of murder. And more of those should have been reported. Very few were. And the question time after time is, should more have been reported? Yes, absolutely. And you have to go hospital by hospital, case by case, and really look at which instance should have been reported.
Right. I want to move on to talk about Charlie Cullen in a moment here. But, I mean, an obvious motive for a hospital to be careful about telling anybody else that they had somebody in their system who harmed or killed a patient is fear of lawsuits, right?
Absolutely. And that's a legitimate fear. Hospitals get sued all the time. They have to carry huge insurance burdens, as do doctors. Their first instinct is to cover themselves. And I don't mean to confuse that with a cover-up. I don't know that that was always the case. It is beyond the imagination of most people, most hospital administrators, to ever think that their staff are killing their patients. They're really there to do the opposite. So it does take a leap of imagination. I do know that the first actions you see time and time again at these hospitals is a legal action rather than an effective investigative reaction. And oftentimes you'll find that what comes in, certainly in retrospect, to be a real burden of evidence against one guy, Charles Cullen, even before they can say for sure what he's doing, when it starts to really look like this guy is dirty, that's the time he gets moved on, one way or the other. He's pushed out or pressured out. So did the hospitals know? That's a question a reader needs to ask, and I think I provide enough evidence that they'll be able to draw that conclusion. But certainly, he should have been stopped before he was, and because he wasn't, he killed a lot more people.
Let's talk about Charlie Cullen. Very troubled childhood, right?
Yeah, he describes it as miserable. This is a really dark period, not only for Charlie, but also for anyone investigating Charlie Cullen. It's a land of shadows, a world he doesn't talk very much about. It's a world that if you were to ask him straight about his childhood, you would not get very much. You tend to learn more about his childhood talking about other topics and then hearing echoes of his childhood, references. He grew up the youngest of 8, youngest by a long shot, sort of a unexpected child. His father died only months after his birth. His mother survived largely on sewing and charity. There was a sickly aunt that had moved in with him. He had 2 brothers with chemical abuse problems and a host of sisters that came in and out of the house. And he felt extremely close to his mother. His mother was the figure that protected him. But the darkness in that house and exactly what happened in that house set the tone for the rest of his life.
Darkness meaning like drug addicts coming in, doing who knows what in rooms, abusing him in some cases?
It's really hard to say. When asked directly about abuse of that sort in the house, he gets very angry. He's gotten very angry with family members, with ex-wives, when they've tried to get him to seek counseling, when they've tried to take him aside, because the pattern, it certainly seems to fit the pattern. He won't say, but he felt unsafe. There were strange men in and out of that house. He had a brother-in-law that came to live with one of his sisters when his sister was pregnant. There was a lot of domestic abuse surrounding that. Exactly what happened to the child is not clear. But eventually the sister ran away, but the brother-in-law stayed. And he and Charlie had a tortured relationship that Charlie had reported to at least one, if not two, of his later lovers, that that he'd tried to poison that brother's drink with he put lighter fluid in the vodka, which is sort of an early example of what would become his pattern for life, a way of passively dealing with things.
So how did it all finally come apart? What did Charlie do that finally led to the criminal investigation that put him away?
Nothing that he hadn't done before. It did finally catch up with him. There was a gathering steam of evidence behind him that, you know, you can only have so many investigations, especially in the mounting age of computers and linked databases, to not be able to connect the dots. But what happened was he was at Somerset Medical Center. A number of patients were coding mysteriously. The hospital noticed it. They had a number of meetings. They asked an assistant pharmacist to call the poison control people to see if they could get help. And in the process of asking for help with the math, of course, the facts of this started to come out. And alarm bells naturally started to ring outside of the hospital at New Jersey Poison Control. It was Dr. Bruce Ruck who first was alerted, and he alerted his boss, Dr. Stephen Marcus. And Marcus very bluntly took it to the administration of Somerset and said, if you're slow rolling this, you're going to look terrible with your pants down. It looks like someone's killing patients in your medical center. And if you don't call, I'm going to call. And by the way, I've got this on tape.
So the Somerset County Prosecutor's Office launches an investigation, and this is not the kind of thing they're used to doing. They don't have a lot of heavy-duty murders there anyway, and this is a very specialized kind of crime. Two detectives, Tim Braun, Danny Baldwin, get assigned. And, of course, they know that, you know, that most of the information is going to be at the hospital. They approach the hospital. What do they get?
Right. These guys, Tim and Danny, I spent a lot of time with them. They're really great guys, interesting characters, and were really blunt with me. They came from Newark, which was the murder capital of the world, when they were there, Newark Homicide. And as Tim put it, me and Danny, you know, we're street guys. We're blood and guts guys. You know, give me a good old-fashioned street murder as opposed to this Latin stuff. Because what they were presented with was they weren't even sure if they had a murder. They thought maybe it was just a well-connected guy and some sort of a litigious situation where they couldn't figure out where inappropriate drugs had come from or gone to.
A well-connected victim trying to make something of it, right.
Exactly, right. A well-connected victim because it's a wealthy county. Not a lot of murder there. And they proceed because they have to. They've got stacks of medical charts, which apparently the hospital themselves had already gone through, you know, as they would put it. Guys with letters after their name had already looked at this stuff for 4 months and they didn't find anything. Now they're handing it to us like we're going to, you know, trace this thing like a bullet. They were completely confused.
But here's what's fascinating. So they give the hospital people, having conducted their own investigation, having spoken to many, many nurses and other staff, give these detectives, I think, a four-page document, which is not very informative, and then tell the detectives they did not take notes in their interviews of the nurses and other staff, which just seems completely unbelievable, doesn't it?
It did to them.
Yeah,
they were really upset. Tim and Danny, the detectives, were very upset. Didn't strike them as being true or helpful.
Right. Now there was another thing. There was a technical system that the hospital had for dispensing medication, which keeps a record when a nurse has to log in to request and withdraw medication or to cancel a previous request. And so there is data on which nurses have requested which medications, date and time. Right.
Right.
And when the detectives ask for that data about these nurses in the patients in question, they are told what?
Right. It's called a Pyxis machine, and they ask for the records. It would be like asking for all the receipts for the last, you know, period of time that you say these victims died over this period of time. Can we see everything that happened to them? And they are told flatly that all those records are erased from the system 2 months after, which would mean that every single victim that they're looking at has no medication records.
And then when they check with the company that makes the system, they discover what?
Yes, yeah, so quite a few steps later, when they're beating their heads against the wall, saying, "How do we solve maybe murder with no evidence whatsoever, not even a paper trail?" In fact, they're questioning whether they're even murders and contemplating early retirement. They do call the company that owns the thing, and the immediate response is, "No, of course, it's all the data is stored forever. Why would it dump data every 2 months? That doesn't make any sense. Are you having a problem with your machine?" And that creates a whole new dynamic. That really is what cracks the case. It also really pisses off the detectives.
All right. And we should say that there were never any actions, any official or criminal actions taken against hospital administrations for any of these events, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
As far as I know, that is correct.
So what does Charlie Cullen stand convicted of? And do we know how many people he may have actually killed?
We'll never know how many people Charlie Cullen ultimately killed. Charlie Cullen doesn't know how many people he killed. He initially could recall 40 and also said there was a large part of his life that was a fog during which he would have no ability to recall. But during that fog, those fogs lasted years, and he said that there were probably multiples a week to other detectives. He was convicted of at least 29, and then in civil court, another, I believe, 8. The specifics are confusing because the further back you go, the fewer records there are. There are no medical records, really, that come out of St. Barnabas. There are very few records of that initial investigation. There are no bodies that one could look at. And so during that 5 years, you've got one murder, even though Cullen himself has said there.
That's the first hospital where he worked in the burn unit and was so active.
Exactly. Right. So, but fast forward 16 years. And look at the last 6 months, right before he's caught, where there are bodies in the ground that can be autopsied. There are medical records they discover. There's both the patient charts and, you know, all the machines, everything computerized, everything available they discover finally. And you've got 16 murders in the last 6 months. So we'll never know.
It could be hundreds.
According to some psychological profilers that have intimate knowledge of this case, it's likely hundreds.
Charles Graber's new book is called The Good Nurse. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Dave Davies online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancuti.